Lecture 12, Northwestern University, Materials Science and Engineering 405, Physics of Solids, Professor Mark Persom, October 6, 2006.
Okay, let's get started. Last time we began to address the issue of angular momentum in quantum mechanics. And I told you there's an easy and a hard way to do this. We're going to go the easy path, at least easy mathematically, but more abstract, more conceptual. So if anything's going too quickly, feel free to slow me down by asking a question. I want to remind you of some of the things we derived last time. We derived the fundamental commutation relationships for angular momentum. Let me remind you of those. Lx, Ly is equal to I h bar Lz. And of course, you can cycle through the three coordinates. And as a result, Ly, Lz is equal to I h bar Lx. And finally, Lz, Lx is equal to I h bar Ly. From this, we would deduce that the individual components of angular momentum are incompatible observables. So we cannot know Lx, Ly, and Lz with absolute certainty at the same time. However, we then showed that L squared, comma any particular component of angular momentum was equal to zero. And in particular, we're going to consider L sub z, and I said we chose L sub z because the z-axis in spherical coordinates is the highest degree of symmetry, or the easiest way to define it with respect to one angular coordinate, which is theta. And as a result, because these two do commute, it implies that we can find simultaneous eigenstates of L squared and L sub z. That is, there will be one quantum state which we can know L squared and L sub z with perfect certainty concurrently. Mathematically, what this statement implies is that we could come with some eigenfunction f, which if L squared operated on it, it would give back an eigenstate, a definite value of L squared, times that eigenfunction. And for the same eigenfunction f, if Lz operated on it, we would get some other eigenvalue of L sub z, which I've called mu, which is a constant, times f. Okay. So really the fundamental question is, what are lambda and mu? And to do that, of course, we could plug in what L squared and L sub z are. L squared and L sub z are a number of derivatives, as we wrote down last time. It's going to be most convenient to do this in spherical coordinates. And so L squared in spherical coordinates, we'll see in a minute, is a big series of derivatives very similar to the Laplacian in spherical coordinates. And so that's the hard way to move forward. We're going to go the easy path. And how we're going to do it is by introducing the angular momentum ladder operator and we'll have a raising and a lowering operator just like we had for the harmonic oscillator potential in 1D. And this will be equal to Lx plus or minus I Ly. When we began to manipulate this operator last time, let me remind you of one of the results which we determined. In particular, if L squared operated on the raising and lowering operator operating on F, we found that this was equal to lambda times the raising and lowering operator operating on F. That is, if F is an eigenfunction of L squared with eigenvalue lambda, if we use the raising and lowering operator on that eigenfunction, we get out another eigenfunction with the same eigenvalue lambda. We then did the same thing for L sub z. If that operated on the raising and lowering operator operating on F, we got out mu plus or minus h bar times L plus or minus operating on F. That is, if F is an eigenfunction of L sub z with eigenvalue mu, then if we employ the raising and lowering operator on F, we also get out an eigenfunction But this new eigenfunction will have an eigenvalue of mu plus or minus h bar. So this raises mu, that is the eigenvalue of L sub z, by h bar, or lowers it by h bar. Okay. So can everybody see why this is considered a raising operator and this a lowering operator? Okay. So what this tells us is that the raising-lowering operator increases the value of L sub z while keeping L squared constant. So what you can think about this is that the overall vector's magnitude squared is remaining constant. All we're doing is changing the component in the z direction. Now, if we were to keep using the raising operator over and over again, the L sub z component would increase, but of course L is remaining constant. If you do this too many times, then the L sub z component itself would become greater than L. And of course, that doesn't make any sense. And as a result, you cannot employ the raising operator indefinitely. There will be some maximum value above which we cannot raise any further. So this is the important piece of physics here. We cannot raise L sub z indefinitely. Since eventually the z component would exceed the total. And of course that makes no sense physically. Similarly with the lowering operator, we can only go so low, because eventually L sub z, or negative, if you want to think about it as a negative value of L sub z, will also exceed the total value of the angular momentum. This implies that on this ladder, there must be a top rung. This top rung, if we were to employ the raising operator another time on what I'm calling f sub t, the top rung, or the top eigenfunction, this would equal zero. Okay, so this is L plus and this is f sub t. It looks similar. So I hope you can keep track of them. Does everybody agree with this statement? Okay. Well, we're now going to say, since we know that at the top rung there will be some total eigenvalue, which is a constant, we're now going to call that top eigenvalue h bar sub L. So this is suggestive. This will end up being the same L as we found from the angular equation. For now, it's just some constant. So let h bar sub L, or h bar times L, be the eigenvalue of L sub z at the top of the ladder. And as a result, if we had L sub z operate on the top eigenfunction, we'd get out h bar times L times f sub t. And of course, as was always the case for L squared, we said that lambda would remain a constant. Sorry, here we said that lambda would remain a constant even as we raised and lowered. And as a result, L squared operating on the top rung will of course give us lambda times the top rung, because it always gives lambda back, no matter how many times we raise or lower it. Is everybody okay with that? Okay. Now I need to point out one other identity of these raising and lowering operators. In particular, if we had the raising-lowering operator operate on the lowering or raising operator, this of course is equal to Lx plus or minus I Ly times Lx minus plus I Ly. This is equal to Lx squared plus Ly squared minus plus I Lx Ly minus Ly Lx. But Lx Ly minus Ly Lx is just the commutation relationship for Lx comma Ly, which we know is fundamentally known to be I h bar Lz. And so this is equal to Lx squared plus Ly squared minus plus I times I h bar LZ. And as a result, if we wanted to now solve for L squared, this will be equal to L plus or minus L minus plus plus LZ squared minus plus h bar LZ. Because L squared is just LX squared plus LY squared plus LZ squared. And if we were to manipulate these terms to the left-hand side, we would get back the original identity which we proved. So does everybody agree that L squared can be written in the following form? Okay. The reason why this is important is that we know that L squared operating on FT is lambda times FT. And as a result, L squared F sub T is just equal to, we could choose either the minus plus plus or the plus minus minus. We're going to choose minus plus plus to begin with. We'll see in a second why. L minus L plus plus L sub Z squared plus H bar L sub Z operating on F sub T. But remember, we said that L plus operating on FT is 0 because we can't go any higher. This is the top rung. And so this first term is 0. The second term here, L sub Z operating on F sub T, we know is H bar times L times F sub T. And of course, this would be H bar squared times L squared because LZ is squared here. And as a result, this is equal to 0, the first term, plus H bar squared L squared plus H bar squared L operating on F sub T. But we know that when L squared operates on F sub T, this is just equal to lambda times F sub T. And as a result, we now see that lambda is equal to H bar squared L, L plus 1. Okay. So the eigenvalue for L squared, we now express in terms of this L. Now this L is not obvious yet that it's related to the spherical harmonics, but it will be. And so now we see that L, the quantum number from the hydrogen atom, says something specifically about the magnitude squared of the angular momentum. So I mentioned before that this not only applies to the top rung, but also the bottom rung. So similarly, there must be a bottom rung. Such that if we tried to lower below the bottom rung, we'd also get nothing back. We're now going to let H bar times L bar, so L bar is just some other value of L, be the eigenvalue of L sub Z at the bottom. And as a result, L sub Z operating on the bottom will give out H bar L bar F sub B. And of course, as always, when L squared operates on any rung of the ladder, we get out lambda. So we're going to do the exact same analysis, but this time we're going to choose L plus, L minus, and the minus sign here, and substitute in for L squared. And so L squared operating on F sub B will be equal to L plus, L minus, plus L squared, minus H bar LZ, F sub B. But we know that L minus operating F sub B is 0, so the first term is 0. The second term will be H bar squared L bar squared. This term here will be H bar times H bar times L bar. And as a result, the second term is plus H bar squared L bar squared minus H bar squared L bar F sub B. And as always, this is equal to the constant lambda. And so we can see that lambda is also equal to H bar squared L bar times L bar minus 1. Now we can see that lambda is a constant, and as a result, this term here and this term here have to be equal to one another. And so from the analysis of the top and bottom rungs, we see that L plus, or L times L plus 1 will be equal to L bar times L bar minus 1. And this implies one of two solutions. One possibility is that L bar equals L plus 1. Right? If we plugged in, we get L plus 1 here, and here we get L plus 1 minus 1, which is just L. So they would be equivalent to one another. But if we think about what that means is that the bottom rung is actually above the top rung. Of course, that doesn't make any sense. And as a result, this solution is not allowed. The other solution is that L bar equals negative L, where if we plugged it in, we get negative L here and negative L minus 1. We multiply through by negative 1, and we get L times L plus 1, which is equivalent. This makes sense because L is the top, so negative L would be the bottom, assuming that L is some positive number. Okay. So we know that the bottom rung is negative L. Each time we apply the raising operator, we're going to increase the value by m h bar all the way up until we get to l h bar, which would be the top of the ladder. So what that implies is as we go between minus l and plus l, we're going to take n integer valued steps. So this implies that the eigenvalues of L sub z are m h bar, where m runs from minus L to plus L in n integer steps. Now, m, we don't know what it is. It's some number. Or we're going to find out later that m is related to the spherical harmonics. For now, it's just some value. What this implies is that if we go from minus L to plus L, there's n intercepts in between. It means that L is equal to negative L plus n, where n is an integer. If we move this L to the other side, we have 2L equals n, which implies that L equals n over 2. And this implies that L must be an integer or half integer. Now, we haven't proven yet that L is the same L as from the angular equation, but if you recall from the angular equation, we found that L had to be a whole number, not half of a whole number. So the question is, what are these half integer solutions telling us? We'll see in a minute that other forms of angular momentum, in particular the intrinsic angular momentum, will accept the half-integer values. And as a result, it will be possible to have half-integer values of spin, the intrinsic angular momentum. This is a very fundamental result, the fact that both full-integer and half-integer values are allowed. It's only because of the constraints of the angular equation that the half-integer values are disallowed. So any form of angular momentum which does not follow the same boundary conditions as the angular equation will allow half-integer values. Spin will be the most important example of that. Okay. So in summary, what we've shown is that L squared operating on an eigenfunction f, we now see that f is dictated by two quantum numbers, L and m, so I'm going to call it f sub L superscript m, is equal to h bar squared L plus 1, f sub L superscript m, and in addition, L sub z, f sub L superscript m, will be equal to h bar m, f sub L superscript m, where L can be 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, etc., and m equals negative L plus 1, up to L minus 1, comma L. So there's 2L plus 1 rungs on the ladder. And in the absence of any other boundary conditions, this would be true. So any form of angular momentum for which there are not additional boundary conditions, this is the case. Spin will be an example of that. So it will be possible to have spin 0, spin 1 half, spin 1, spin 3 halves, etc. And there will be certain elementary particles which possess all of those values of spin. We'll find that material science, the only one which is, well, there's two which are important. Spin equal 1 half, which will correspond to electrons, and spin equals 1, which will correspond to photons and phonons. Okay, so one thing which we don't know are what are F sub L superscript M. So we need to determine the eigenfunctions. So to determine the eigenfunctions, now we have no choice but to write down or express L squared and L sub z in spherical coordinates. Okay, we defined L squared and L sub z in Cartesian coordinates. So you'd have to do a transformation from Cartesian coordinates to spherical coordinates. This you can imagine is messy, so I'm not going to do it on the board. It's in Griffiths if you want to see it. What happens is that L sub z ends up being pretty simple. It's just equal to h bar over I partial with respect to phi. And again, as I've suggested many times, the z component of any vector tends to be the simplest to express in spherical coordinates, and that's the case. L squared is equal to negative h bar squared times 1 over sine theta partial with respect to theta, sine theta partial with respect to theta, plus 1 over sine squared theta second partial with respect to phi. And so this should look familiar to us because it looks very similar to the Laplacian in spherical coordinates. So in particular, if we want to calculate what F sub L superscript M is, we'd have to input it into L sub Z and L squared. Let's do L squared first. L squared F L M is equal to negative H bar squared 1 over sine theta partial with respect to theta, sine theta partial with respect to theta, plus 1 over sine squared theta second partial with respect to phi, operating on F sub L superscript M, and that will be equal to H bar squared L, L plus 1, which is the eigenvalue of L squared, operating on F sub L superscript M. And this should look familiar to us because this is precisely the angular equation. Similarly, we know that L sub z operating on FLM will be equal to h bar over I partial with respect to phi operating on FLM, which is equal to the eigenvalue h bar m FLM. And this is equivalent to the capital phi equation and as a result, since we've already solved these two equations, we know that the solutions to these differential equations are simply the spherical harmonics. Of course, the spherical harmonics, we know from the boundary conditions in the hydrogen atom, imply that L can only have integer values. And so we have to throw out the half-integer values for the extrinsic angular momentum. So since we already solved these equations, we can recognize that the eigenfunctions of L squared and L sub z are simply the spherical harmonics from the hydrogen atom. The spherical harmonics are the eigenfunctions of L squared and L sub z. In an undergraduate quantum, I just assert this to be true, but now we see precisely why it's the case. What this tells us is that when we solved the Coulomb potential, that is the hydrogen atom, using separation of variables, what we simultaneously found when we found the wave functions were eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian, which gave us energy, L squared, and L sub z. And so for the hydrogen atom, by separation of variables, we inadvertently, or serendipitously, we inadvertently found eigenfunctions of the Hamiltonian, L squared, and L sub z. That is, the wave functions that we found for the hydrogen atom, if H operated on them, we know we get E out. So E is an eigenvalue. In addition, L squared operating on psi gives us out the eigenvalue of L squared, which we now know is H bar squared L, L plus 1, so L has a real physical meaning. And finally, L sub z operating on psi is equal to H bar M psi. So M has a real physical meaning. It's related to the eigenvalue of L sub z. But as I've already alluded to, for the hydrogen atom, we found that L could only be integer valued. So the half-integer values we discard due to the boundary conditions. So the question is, are these half-integer values real, are they useful, or are they spurious? And so that brings us to the next topic, which is spin. So before I do that, is everybody comfortable with extrinsic angular momentum in the hydrogen atom? Okay. The good news is we only had to write down derivatives at the very end. Everything else was just algebraic, and that's the beauty of this approach. And with that said, everything that we wrote down made no assumptions about the form of angular momentum. As long as angular momentum exists, then we know that everything up to this point will be true. And what we concluded is that the quantum number L is 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, 2, etc. So if we can discover other forms of angular momentum, then perhaps those half-integer values will become available to us. So that brings us to spin. So before we talk quantum mechanically about spin, let's talk classically. So if we have a rigid object, it can have two kinds of angular momentum. The first is orbital. And orbital is what we've just been talking about. It's often known as extrinsic L, which is R cross P. But the other, which is either known as intrinsic angular momentum or spin, is that spin is equal to I, the moment of inertia, times the angular frequency. And in classical physics, when these two concepts are introduced, you typically think of the Earth orbiting the Sun. It orbits the Sun, it has orbital angular momentum, but it's also spinning on its axis. So it has intrinsic angular momentum related to its angular frequency and its moment of inertia. So that's classical. Quantum mechanically, a point particle can also have another form of angular momentum. Which is also called spin. And as I mentioned, when we derived these equations for angular momentum, we made no assumptions about what the eigenfunctions were. And so this analysis is true for any form of angular momentum. And as a result, spin will have two quantum numbers. Which I'm going to call S, which is equivalent to L. And we'll have another value, M, but I'm going to call it M sub S now, because now we have two values of M. Okay. One thing I want to point out, and this is a difficult concept to accept, because classically, spin you can think of very simply in terms of extrinsic angular momentum. In particular, if you think of the Earth spinning on its axis, if you took each dust particle in the Earth, and you calculated its extrinsic angular momentum, and then you summed over all the dust particles in the Earth, you would get out its spin. So you can decompose spin into the extrinsic angular momentum of its component parts. Quantum mechanically, however, a point particle, like an electron, there is no component parts. It is a fundamental particle, but it still has spin. So you can only take this analogy so far. To really understand the basis of spin, we have no choice but to go to the Dirac equation, which is the relativistic form of quantum mechanics, which we will not do in this course. It's way too involved for the time that we have. But if it really bothers you, if you just can't accept spin, that's what I would recommend, a course in the physics department which addresses the Dirac equation. If you don't want to deal with the Dirac equation, then all you have to accept is that spin is possible. Intrinsic angular momentum exists in quantum mechanics. And everything that we've done here will be the same, except now we have S and M sub S. The point, though, is that this intrinsic angular momentum is independent of any spatial coordinate. And as a result, there are no boundary conditions. So the half-integer values are acceptable. There's nothing eliminating them. Okay. So the important thing here is that these point particles do have angular momentum. And this angular momentum, this spin angular momentum, is independent of space. And that's, of course, the hardest thing to accept. But it's true. And is described by the following commutation relations. So this is why we spent all this time doing angular momentum in an abstract way, because spin is super abstract. There's no spatial components to it. But we didn't have to use any spatial dependence to derive these relationships. And so the commutation relationships that you can probably expect is that S sub X comma S sub Y is equal to I H bar S sub Z, just like extrinsic angular momentum. S Y comma S Z is equal to I H bar SX, and SZ comma SY is equal to I H bar, sorry, SX is equal to I H bar SY. So if we use this, what you've noticed here is that the Schrodinger equation by itself does not explain spin. We have to just add these commutation relationships as postulates. They would be a consequence of the Dirac equation, which we aren't handling in this course. So all we have to do is accept this as a postulate, which is reasonable, I think, based upon what we've just done for the last 2 days. And once you accept this postulate, this is the only assumption that we made in deriving that relationship, or this relationship here, which I'm about to erase. And so if we accept that as a postulate of spin, then what I'm erasing right now is a logical consequence of it. And as a result, if you have, like I said, if you're having trouble with spin, what you want to do is take enough physics to derive these three equations, and then the rest follows. Okay. What these three commutation relationships, of course, imply is that S squared, operating on some eigenfunction, which is labeled with two quantum numbers, S and M sub S, will be equal to h bar squared s, s plus 1, s m sub s. Now this notation here is typical in quantum mechanics, at least in higher level quantum mechanics, because it implies no spatial dependence. It's just a state labeled by two quantum numbers. Okay. And similarly, S sub z, operating on this eigenstate labeled with two quantum numbers S and M sub s, will be equal to H bar M sub s times this eigenstate with two quantum numbers S and M sub s. Furthermore, S, we know, can have values of 0, 1 half, 1, 3 halves, 2, etc. And there's no constraint eliminating the half integer values, so they're still here. And M sub s will equal negative s plus 1 up to s minus 1, comma s. So there's two s plus 1 values of s. The last thing which I'm going to inform you of is that every elementary particle has a specific and immutable value of S. This is different than the hydrogen atom. Remember, in the hydrogen atom, we could have different values of L, 0, 1, 2, etc. But for a particular particle, you can only have one value of S. Question?
I'm a little confused by this notation that you're using. You're putting S and M sub S in the ket together, so are they one eigenfunction?
Correct. It's an eigenfunction which is uniquely labeled by two quantum numbers. How I did this before is I wrote it like F sub L superscript M.
No, I understand.
Yeah. This notation is chosen to is meant to eliminate confusion. It may not be successful. It's meant to imply no spatial dependence. So if you prefer to write it like that or however you want, it would be okay. So every particle has a specific and immutable value of S. This is different from extrinsic angular momentum. We can convert a state from an L equals 0 to an L equals 1 state. An electron can go from L equals 0 to L equals 1. But an electron can only have one value of S, period. Nothing you can do about it. So let's look at some examples of fundamental particles. From particle physics, pi mesons are believed at least to have spin 0. Electrons, which are of course important for solid-state physics, have spin 1/2. Photons, which are also important for solid-state physics, and therefore material science, have spin 1. There are, of course, other fundamental particles. Deltas have spin 3/2. Gravitons have spin 2. And you could go on and on. All that I'm pointing out is that each elementary particle has a specific and immutable value of spin. What we're going to do in a minute is classify these fundamental particles into two classes. One will be known as fermions. Fermions will have half-integer values of spin. So electrons and deltas would be fermions. And the second class will be bosons, which have integer values of spin. And so pi mesons, photons, gravitons would be bosons. We're going to find that the counting statistics for bosons and fermions are fundamentally different. And the consequence of those counting statistics for the fermions will be the Pauli exclusion principle, which is the last thing we need to complete the periodic table. Okay. So, as I just said, we can categorize two classes of particles. First class, I'm going to call bosons. And these are particles with integer spin. For example, photons and phonons. These are the two which are most important to solid-state physics. As I suggested, the counting statistics are different for bosons and fermions. In particular, if you have two identical bosons, so this is the first time in this course where we're considering more than one particle at the same time. So let's say we have two. If you have two identical bosons in distinct quantum states, A and B, the total wave function is, now we have two particles, so they're each going to have their own spatial coordinate, R1 and R2. It'll be equal to some normalization constant A times psi sub A R1, that is particle 1 being in state A, times psi sub B, particle 2 being in state B, plus psi sub B R1 times psi sub A R2. Now again, this is kind of sloppy notation because these should each be quantum states, not necessarily the solution to the Schrodinger equation. So these will also include spin. This again, I'm not deriving, I'm stating it as a postulate, if you will. It's a consequence of the Dirac equation. Why I'm bothering telling you about this is that what I want you to consider is that if both particles are in state A, we have to substitute B or A equal to B here and there. The total wave function now is psi of R1, R2. These two terms will be equal to one another, so we're going to get a term 2 out in front, times A, times psi A, R1, psi A, R2. And this is a perfectly acceptable wave function for us. And as a result, we'll conclude that for bosons, there can be many bosons in the same state. Okay. Now, this may or may not seem strange to you. What it implies, though, if you have a system which has many bosons in it, and say you cool it down in temperature, such that they all fall into the ground state, that is acceptable. And so you can have all of your particles in the ground state of your quantum system. This is often referred to as a Bose-Einstein condensate, and leads to very unusual properties such as superfluidity of helium, liquid helium. We're going to see that that particular consequence doesn't have a lot of impact on solid-state physics. But the case of fermions will have a dramatic impact on solid-state physics. Okay. In particular, let's now consider the other class of particle, fermions, which are particles with half integer spin. For example, protons, electrons, etc. Let's take the specific case of electrons. Electrons are spin 1/2 particles. So that tells you S equals 1/2. M sub S can run from minus S to plus S. And so minus 1/2 and 1/2 will be the available values of M sub S. There are only two possibilities, and so chemists will often just refer to this as spin down and spin up. So you probably or may have heard those terms previously. They're referring to the two different quantum numbers available for M sub S. Okay. Now let's consider the cases if you have two identical fermions in states A and B. The total wave function will be psi, which is of course a function of both spatial coordinates for each of the particles. Some normalization constant A times psi A, R1, psi B, R2, which is the same as we just had. But now the wave function is forced to be anti-symmetric, so we have a minus sign here. Psi sub B, R1, psi sub A, R2. And this minus sign makes all the difference. It will imply the difference between the possibility of a Bose-Einstein condensate, which is true for bosons. For fermions, it will be impossible to have two electrons in the same state, or any two fermions in the same state. Because if we look, if both particles are in the same state, let's say A, then we see that these two terms will cancel. We get no wave function, which of course doesn't make any sense. And as a result, what we conclude from this analysis is that there cannot be more than one fermion in the same quantum state. This statement here is a famous one, known as the Pauli exclusion principle. It applies to any fermion, and in particular to electrons. And as a result, it implies that if we try to pour more than one electron, for example, into the hydrogen atom, we'll first fill up the n equal 1 states. We know that there's only one value of L, which is equal to 0, and only one value of m, which is equal to 0. And now we know there's two values of m sub s, which are allowed, spin up and spin down. So you can only put two electrons into the n equal 1 state. And as a result, there's only two atoms in the first row of the periodic table. If we go to n equals 2, then L can equal 0 or 1. M will equal 0 for L equals 0, but it can equal minus 1, 0, or 1 for L equals 1. M sub s can be plus or minus 1 half for each of those, as we get 8 possible states. And so we see 8 atoms in the second row of the periodic table. So we at least resolve this factor of 2 problem by realizing that spin can have two values and the Pauli exclusion principle. Otherwise, we may have thought that why don't we just pour all of the electrons into the ground state? Without the Pauli exclusion principle, that would have been a perfectly reasonable thing to think. And if electrons were bosons, that would be the case. Let me point out another detail, which will be important for much of chemistry, in particular bonding. If we were to exchange the two particles, we see that we get back the wave function for bosons and the negative wave function for fermions. So the plus case is for bosons, and so we'll call this a symmetric case. The minus sign is for fermions. This will be the anti-symmetric case. And I should point out that the anti-symmetry condition for fermions is a condition for the entire wave function, i.e. space and spin. Because remember, spin is independent of space. So what this tells you is if you're trying to form a bond, for example, and both of the electrons in that bond are both spin up, that would imply that the wave functions have to be anti-symmetric. This will often be referred to as a triplet state, because you'll take the sum of these two spins, 1 half plus 1 half, which is 1, So S is now 1, and we know that M sub S can run from minus S to plus S. So you can have M sub S equal to minus 1, 0, or 1. So there's three possibilities, i.e. triplet. Whereas if the two electrons in the bond were anti-parallel, then their wave function could be symmetric. That will lead to a bonding state. And of course, the total spin will be 1 half minus 1 half, which is 0. And M sub S can only be 0. And that will be known as a singlet state. So we're not going to be talking a lot about the details of chemical bonding, but if you ever hear this later in a chemistry course, this is what it's referring to. Because this is very important for bonding, among other things. So in summary, four quantum numbers uniquely describe electrons, which is where we all started this discussion on, in a spherically symmetric Coulomb potential. N, which is 1, 2, etc. L, which we know can run between 0 and n minus 1. Absolute value of M sub L, which is less than or equal to L. And M sub S, which should equal plus or minus 1 half. The reason why I don't put S as one of these is because it doesn't tell us any more information. Because S is always 1 half, no matter what we do. But M sub S can have two unique values. And the final thing you need to know is that no two electrons can be in the same state, according to the Pauli exclusion principle. So this completes our analysis of hydrogen completely. We're done. But a fair question to ask is, what about the rest of the periodic table? We couldn't do a lot of material science with only hydrogen as an available element, so we have no choice but to address the rest of the periodic table. And you can already see there's a problem, because if it was just like the hydrogen atom, then we would expect 2, 8, 18, etc., number of atoms in each row of the periodic table, which is not the case. There's something which we're neglecting, and that is, of course, when you have more than one electron, there'll be an electron-electron repulsion. That repulsion will, of course, break the spherical symmetry, and as a result, you'd expect the hydrogen atom solutions to change slightly. That will be the case. Qualitatively, the orbitals will be the same, but the energy of the orbital will be slightly different. And as a result, what we'll find is that when you go to the third row of the periodic table, you'd expect there to be 3s, 3p, and 3d orbitals, but we'll find that the 4s orbitals are lower energy than 3d. And as a result, we jump down to the next row of the periodic table and build up. And as we go across, we'll get the 4s, then we'll fill in the 3ds, then we'll go to 4p, instead of going to 4d, we'll go to 5s, then we'll fill in, etc. And so that splitting of the degeneracy by the electron-electron repulsion is what leads to the richness of the periodic table, or the complication of the periodic table, depending upon your perspective. The point is that even for the next simplest atom, helium, we could spend the rest of the quarter trying to solve it analytically, and it's impossible. There's no exact solution for this many-body problem. And so what we're going to have to do is embrace some approximate form of solution to the Schrodinger equation. In fact, for anything beyond hydrogen, we have to start to approximate the solution. And that's what we'll do next week, is learn how we would approximate solutions. We'll consider helium and talk generally about how you could do any potential that you're faced with in quantum mechanics. All right, see you then.
MSE 405.